Do you eat, sleep, and breathe golf? Do you love to explore? And most importantly, do you just want to have some fun? Well, then welcome to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. Now here's the guy with all the questions, Mitch Lawrence, and the guy with all the answers, Darren Bunch.
Welcome once again to Talking Golf Getaways, and while we're at it, welcome to a new era, dare we say, in the evolution of the Golf News Net platform in more ways than one. Darren, not only do we have something new and a little different content-wise, something I and I know you are very excited about on today's supersized podcast, something that you have envisioned for a while now we are trying for the very first time, and I think people are going to love, but also we have
bum, bum, bum.
The big announcement. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, there it is, drum roll, an actual drum roll, about our new online home, and this is stinking exciting.
Oh, no doubt. I can safely say the entire team, me, you, Ryan Ballingy, Eric Hart, Brian Orr, photographer extraordinaire.
Drink, and I am.
We're all very excited. It's been a lot of long hours developing our new website. We're happy to launch. And the launch is finally here. So I'm going to let you make the formal official announcement, but not just yet. First, we're going to talk a little bit, just a quick minute, about what this episode 127 of Talking Golf Getaways has in store and why it's different from pretty much all the other stuff that we normally do.
Yeah, and I think different than anything anybody has done. Because as people know who listen to the podcast, you and I are big fans of David McClay Kidd. He's been on a number of times. We've had incredible conversations with him. He is what I would call kind of an old friend for the Talking Golf Getaways duo here. Everyone should know, and obviously does know, he's behind great courses, Bandon Dunes, the new Mammoth Dunes at Sand Valley. But most importantly, for today's purposes, he's the designer of one of your favorite places to play anywhere in the world. And of course, that will be one of my favorites when I play it. And that is Gamble Sands in Eastern Washington.
That's right. David was generous to, well, we spent about 90 minutes the other day on the phone. And essentially what we did was we talked our way through the 18 holes at Gamble Sands. What I have called an audio playing lesson with the architect. But more officially, we're calling it our Talking Yardage Book series. He gave us insights not only about the construction and the hole designs of every hole, but also personal tips on how he plays a lot of the shots when he's spending his own leisure time up at Gamble Sands now.
You know, you told me about this idea you had probably a couple months ago, I guess. And when you and I were talking about it at the beginning, it was a little, I said, yeah, sounds like a good idea. It was kind of a little bit difficult for me to envision actually doing the whole golf course. But the more we talked about it, and now, given that you've done this with David McClay Kidd, I think this is an absolutely fantastic idea. And people are going to understand why I say that when I listen to you and David. But like you said, it's really important to note this is the first in what we expect will become a whole series on Talking Golf Getaways. More of these talking yardage books, maybe once a month even. What do you think?
I think we find a way to do once a month. There are plenty of golf courses out there that we love.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think that architects, once they hear what you and David did with this 18-hole talking yardage book, I think they're going to get into it too, because the idea to me of being able to, before you play a course, or even if it's one that you're really familiar with, to get the architect's stream of consciousness kind of about all these different things is, like we said, it's different than anything anybody has done. Whether you're in your car, whether you're at the gym on the elliptical like you are for, what, 6-8 hours a day? you know, you can kind of dream along. You dream along with us. You can picture playing, or you go back to holes you've played. Imagine walking some of the fairways, and you get to learn about the history of why decisions were made, the strategy that went into it. I mean, this really is fantastic. And somebody like David is perfect for this kind of thing because he's so articulate and so knows what he was going for at Gamble Sands.
Exactly. It was so much fun to do. And, you know, we'll get into it in a minute, I guess. But speaking of dreaming along with us, Mitch, it's probably time we get into today's even bigger announcement. Not that having DMK on the podcast isn't big, but...
All right, hold up. It was worth two drum rolls. I think, personally. We have teased it for a few episodes now, and today Golf News Net's new golf travel brand, which is Golf Trip Experts, is up and running in cyberspace for all to read at Golf Trip X, the letter X, golftripx.com. Darren, it has been, I know, a labor of web development love for both you and Golf News Net creator Ryan Ballinger. You guys have been working really hard on this. Why don't you tell the listeners why we needed this new website and why we needed it now?
Well, I've written an essay over at golftripx.com for those who want to learn the full story. But the short version is that with the amazing job Ryan has done growing the Golf News Net platform year over year for the last 3 to 4 years, it just struck us that it was time to start talking about expansion. And the logical solution seemed to be, let's give our growing catalog of golf travel content its own home, not just as a place to dream about bucket list destinations and research your golf getaways, but also a place to partner with many of our friends, including Brian Orr's GolfPackagePros.com network, so that we can offer custom quotes, book vacations, and more. We want it to be a resource for all your golf travel needs.
And I know that you were, in case people don't know, your former newspaper and magazine editor, which you did for a long time, and you wanted to make sure that the reader experience on golftripx.com was especially appealing, and it's something that I know you took really, really seriously.
Exactly. Ryan and I spent a lot of time discussing the little details, and I got a lot of input from Eric Hart as well, who is now a golftripx.com associate editor for golf and travel. And we talked about everything from choosing a highly readable text font to streamlining the advertising environment. We want golfers and travelers who come to the site to be able to spend more time actually consuming content, less time battling all the bells and whistles and pop-ups and whatnot that, you know, seem to almost discourage web visitors from, well, you know, actually reading when they get to a website.
What a novel concept.
I know, exactly. Obviously, we're just getting started. There's a lot of content on Golf Trip X already that many people haven't seen before, and a lot that probably got lost in the shuffle over at Golf News Net. So we'll be adding new stories and projects regularly as we work to grow Golf Trip Experts brand the same way we've grown Golf News Net. And of course, golftripx.com will be the new home of Talking Golf Getaways podcast as well.
And that's, I think, for you and I, this is, you know what, a couple of years now, 120-something episodes. And I think for us, it's kind of a big deal because we take pride in this show. We love doing what we do, and there's going to be a lot more and great content coming on the upcoming podcast. And golftripx.com is going to be the perfect place for it. So, hey, man, congratulations.
Thanks. We should drink to it.
I mean, we kind of both do, but it would be nice. Sometime soon, we'll get together and actually do that in person. The new golftripx.com website comes with new social media. As you can imagine, you can reach us on Twitter at golftripexperts. And we'll be announcing accounts on Instagram and Facebook in the coming days as well. As always, you can still reach me at Mitch Lawrence, L-A-U-R-A-N-C-E, on Twitter and Instagram, and Darren at Getaways Golf on Twitter. All right. I think we have run the course on this opening. It's enough for now. We'll be talking more about the Golf Trip Experts brand and golftripx.com in future episodes, as you can imagine. We hope you'll enjoy the content we're providing, just like we hope you are going to enjoy this incredible interview, I believe first of its kind anywhere in the universe, that Darren did with the great David McClay Kidd, our talking yardage book with the architect at Gamble Sands. Take it away, Darren.
David, welcome back to Talking Golf Getaways. We're going to do something kind of new and exciting. I've been wanting to do this for a while now. Take a audio yardage book tour through a course that I love, and we decided we would start with Gamble Sands. I'm looking forward to reliving all 18 holes at Gamble Sands, and hopefully the listeners will be too.
It's a course I know well. I only live in central Oregon, a few hours south of there. So I get to spend a bit of my own leisure time up at Gamble Sands playing golf with friends and talking to a lot of the people that go there. So it's a course I know pretty well.
One of the things I want to talk about just quickly before we get into the actual holes is kind of how you divided up the yardages among tee boxes. You and I have talked about this a little before. The tee boxes range from about 4,800 yards all the way up to well above 7,100 yards. But what you deem the regular tees on the scorecard, which are the green tees, are at 6,200, 6,207 to be exact. I think that's a perfect yardage for what most golfers play. And so I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about your philosophy in really finding the right length of holes for the most golfers.
The 6,200 to 6,400 yard sweet spot, you know, the Goldilocks spot for the average golfer, is something that's taken a number of years for me to appreciate. And really where you see it at its strongest is at Bandon Dunes. If you go play Bandon, all these different courses have been designed by different architects with different philosophies on yardages, on differing pieces of land. And yet, for all of the golf that's played there, the resort management have refined the courses to appeal the most to the guests that come. And all of the courses play in that range. They're all about, you know, 6,200 to 6,400 yards from their regular tee. And the golfers respond to that. They're really enjoying it. And so that would be my number one go-to that says, you know, that is the yardage that people enjoy the most. You can argue all you want about longer or shorter, but Bandon Dunes proves that that Goldilocks yardage is right there. And so I paid attention to that about a decade ago when I was trying to revisit my architectural markers and decide, you know, where I was going to go. When people were saying maybe I was building courses that were too hard, I went back and took a hard look. And sure enough, I went to Bandon Dunes, and that course is played right around 6,300 yards. And I discovered a bunch of other things. I'm not sure if you and I have talked about them before. You know, the average golfer at Bandon Dunes is trying to break 100. And golf course architects have this notion that the average golfer should be playing, you know, a 6,800-yard golf course, and the guy's trying to make birdie against you, and you're trying to not look foolish because he's making too many birdies. Nothing's further from the truth. The guy's playing a 6,300-yard golf course and is struggling to keep in double digits. I don't, you know, golf is hard, and golf course architects don't have to do too much to make it significantly harder.
Yeah, certainly I've proven that at Bandon Dunes. I became notorious a couple of years ago for taking a number of shots out of the front bunker on 15, I believe it was. And, you know, golf, it's fun, but you're right. It's a tough game. And I think one of the great things here at Gamble Sands is you've opened it up. We're going to talk about a lot of different elements of the golf course that help golfers have more fun, try to be more creative with their shots, and really just walk off the golf course saying, I want to get back out there and I want to try it again, because if I didn't execute this shot or that shot, you know, I know I can, or I know I can give it my best try. Is there a hole, when you were walking the course at Gamble Sands, is there a hole that jumped out at you first? Was there something that was kind of, you looked at it and you said, oh yeah, this is the hole that I'm going to kind of build the entire golf course experience around?
You're right to ask that. It's so often the case on a golf course that there are one or three or five holes that jump out at you, and you say, okay, you know, how do I thread a golf course together and hit all of those high spots, you know, existing golf holes that are just screaming to be built? At Gamble Sands, I'm not sure there was an individual spot. There was more of a circulation, a flow around that piece of land. You know, the piece of land is not particularly bold. You know, it's relatively soft on top of that ridge. There's no contours out there that are that push golf away that you couldn't have played golf over. So the golf course could have gone in a number of different ways. And so those big decisions about, you know, where is this going to hub from? Where is the clubhouse going to be? Where are we going to start and finish this? And then the really big thing at Gamble Sands are the giant sand washes that run from north to south and exit the bluff down onto the Columbia River. And those are real impediments. Those are difficult to cross. So the whole golf routing for the first course at Gamble Sands is really predicated by two holes, the 6th and the 14th. Those two holes are the two crossing points of the gulch, the sandy wash. And that at its deepest point, that sandy wash is probably 200 feet deep and 300 yards wide. So you very, very difficult to cross with a golf hole. So I had to figure out how I was going to cross it. The 6th hole, as you know, actually plays into it and then you walk out of it. And the 14th hole plays across it at its highest point when the wash is really nothing more than a shallow depression in the ground as it starts to gather pace and dig itself deeper. So those two holes, and I didn't know what numbers they would be when we first started, but I knew that those two points were essential in a routing. And I knew that I wanted to start and finish at that clubhouse location. So it was really a question of, okay, there's where we want to start. That's the obvious spot. And I have to cross in those two places. And that's where we started. We started scribbling with, you know, pencils and sheets of scratch paper and tried to figure out a circulation around it. And then a lot of walking. trying to figure out, okay, now that could be a par 4 and this is a 3 and then that goes there and then we end up, oh, it doesn't work. Now we get to the crossing point and it has to be a par 3 and we already played 3 of those already. That's not going to work. Back to the start. Okay, now we lay it out a different way until eventually we came up with a flow and a sequence of holes that we liked. But as I say, it was predicated on probably three things: the clubhouse location and where the 6th and 14th lay today.
Very interesting. All right, let's dive in then. You know, we'll assume that we've checked in at the golf shop. We've made a quick walk over to the starter shack. We've gone past the putting green, or maybe we've hit a few golf balls. The driving range is great at Gamble Sands, but...
Stop you for a second.
Sure.
Because that part that you're about to dive past, that is essential to what we were doing at Gamble Sands. We talked about Casey Cranbuehl and I were the two guys on site from the very beginning. And Casey and I talked about what would be our perfect golf experience. If it was us turning up with our buddies, what would be the things we really, really wanted? And we agreed that in a perfect world, we would want to drive up to the clubhouse, drop our stuff, order a beer, and start hitting balls on the range.
Nice.
And putt. You know, we wanted it to be so compact. I mean, I love Bandon Dunes, but I don't love the shuttles. I don't love my 7:50 tea time that then I think, do I eat breakfast or do I go warm up or do I get up at 5 a.m. and try and do it all? You know, we wanted you to be able to roll up to Gamble Sands and 10 minutes before a tea time be able to hit a dozen balls on the range, you know, 3 or 4 minutes of putting and still hit the first tee and have it all unbelievably close together. I mean, the driving range tee flows off of the bar patio. I mean, it's right there. It's literally 10 steps from the outdoor bar onto that driving range tee. And similarly with the putting green, which flows completely into the first tee, that it's actually the same piece of turf that makes the first tee. So you can walk in through the front door, pay your green fee, go out the back door, hit the range, come around the building and putt, and then go right to the starter and tee up in 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's a perfect setup. I totally agree. And that whole area being that compact, especially if you're there with a group, I wasn't part of the group, but I played just behind a group of golf course superintendents last summer. And just seeing all of them interact through those various areas because it's so compact really makes for a camaraderie of a group if you happen to have a group there.
The guys are teeing off on one and they're getting, you know, some heckling off the tee, off the putting green because it's right there. So I think that for that style anywhere. I mean, any club, I think back to the clubs in Scotland, and that's often the way they are. Everything's very compact. The first tee is right by the clubhouse.
Okay, so now we get to the first tee. We've got all the yardages I'm going to mention are going to be from those regular green tees. I've played the golf course from both the green tees and the farther back orange tees, but we're going to stick with the regular tees for the purposes of today. So 353-yard par four. It's got a slightly obscured tee shot, not really a blind shot, but in the sense that you can't see the green from the tee. It's a dogleg left. You know, what are you looking to present to the golfer here on the opening hole?
Probably trying to educate them more on the first hole. I'm trying to get golfers to understand that there's a ground game afoot here, that the ball will run. I think Gamble Sands is the best fescue golf course I've ever seen in the world. And I've seen a few. The turf there that Chip Caswell has maintained is phenomenal. The ball will run out forever. So on that very first hole, I'm trying to say to the golfer, look, you don't have to overpower it. You know, you have to use your brain here. The hole's not particularly long, and the green is slightly obscured on the left. If you've got a caddy with you, which would be the absolute best, he'd probably tell you you need to hit a shot that's maybe, you know, somewhere over a couple of hundred yards. And accuracy is more important than power. So you want the whole dog legs left. The best drive would be down on the left half of the hole. And it doesn't have to be a drive for a lot of people, because that ball is going to run out, could be 30 to 50 yards. So if you could hit a 3-wood down the left-hand side and get it to roll out to 220, you've only got 130 left. And there's the second shot is where it really happens. There's a big inside bunker running all the way up the left-hand side, and it stops about maybe 50 yards short of the green. But the backside of that bunker on the inside left has a soft downhill slope all the way to the front of the green. You can't see it from the fairway, but a caddy would tell you, and if you'd played before, you'd know. So your second shot only has to cover that bunker. And at that point, if you hit a 220 tee shot, that bunker's 70 yards away, 80 yards. So if you flipped over that with a little punchy 9-iron, the ball will crest over the top of that bunker on the left, and it'll roll all the way down and onto the green. And you're on the green with a birdie putt on the first hole, and you barely had to try, but you had to think about it. What a lot of people do is they stand up on the first tee and they beat a driver, and it goes down the right-hand side of the hole towards a fairway bunker that's on the outside right edge. So if they hit it too hard, they're in that bunker. And now they've got a 170-yard bunker shot into the green, pretty hard. If they don't go in the bunker, they're laying next to it with a 170-yard shot into the green, still pretty hard. And they haven't used any of that linksy grass to their advantage. They hit what they thought was a great drive, but they put themselves out of position. And now their only option is to go take dead aim at that pin 160, 170 yards away. So when I play, I often chuckle because, you know, my playing partners who haven't played, they bomb their drives out. They end up in the right-hand fairway bunker. They, you know, they flub it out to 30, 40 yards short of the green. And then they get their 60-degree wedge and they try and, you know, chunk it onto the putting surface and rescue a par, where a rescue club down the left and a little punchy 9-iron would have put them on the green with a birdie putt. So at least if I'm playing with people, I try and get them to see that really fast. Like, this is links golf. This is all about using the contours to your advantage. And there are lots of contours out here that can help you if you'd only listen.
Well, and that's one of the things I think we're going to talk about quite a bit. I mean, this green, I always love the reveal of this green as you get out into the fairway and you can begin to get a glimpse of it. And you see that it's kind of a sizable, kind of a bowl, I guess, a one-sided bowl, because in most cases throughout the golf course, you've got situations where the green is sunken a little bit, and then you kind of walk up the slope of that bowl to get to the next tee. And so those contours on the backside of greens also help, in addition to what you're talking about, whereas if you landed in this case front left and you play it onto the green. But it's a great reveal of that opening tee shot. And I've always loved that it kind of makes you wait for it. You have to hit your shot, get it out in the fairway before you really get to see that that first green.
From the left-hand side, that green will gather because it's like a taco shell. And if you're coming in from the left, you're playing perpendicular into the taco shell. And the ball, if it's thrown even vaguely in the right direction, can't help but fall to the bottom of the taco shell. But if you come in from the right-hand side, you're playing down the length of the taco shell. Well, the taco is not helping you if you're coming in from the right. You'd have to get the distance right yourself. So if you're short or long, the ball is not going to be helped by any contours at all. So down the left, use the taco shell. That would be my advice on the first.
Well, let's assume we've made our birdie putts there. We walk up the slope and we come to hole number two, which if there are signature holes out there, this has to be one of them just purely for the location and the views. But I think it's a truly great short par four early in the round that lets you play it dozens of different ways depending on how you want to attack the hole.
It turned out really, really well. I mean, we intended to build a drivable par four. And the drivable par four is something that's come back into fashion over the last maybe decade, maybe a little longer. But I all too often see it as a hole that lacks strategy. It's considered any hole under, 320 is, you think to yourself, well, that's drivable, and you turn up and all it is a golf hole with a reachable green, but there's no discernible strategy to it. I've built a few of them, and over the years I've figured out, what's fun for me at least is to force the player into a decision, in every regard. With a drivable par four, the option you would think would either be to lay up or to go for it. I think a badly designed drivable par four is one that lets me lay up with whatever I want. As the architect, I don't want to give you that option. I want to make that layup a decision in itself. So on the second hole at Gamble Sands, there's a big fairway bunker right in the middle of the fairway that's sitting where a mid to long iron might land or roll out, where a rescue club would fly directly into. So your layup has to be either before that bunker, which means you're hitting 7 iron, or after that bunker, which probably means you're hitting a full rescue or even a 3 wood or maybe even your driver away from the green into a big fat fairway to the right-hand side. So even if you decide not to go for the green, there's still a decision to be made about where you're going to lay that ball into a safe location to make your next shot.
And even if you do carry that bunker, you still have to take that right-hand line, because the more aggressive left-hand line, there's kind of a ridge of fairway there that then will run balls toward a big bunker that you have left of the green as well, correct?
Yeah, if you're going to carry the fairway bunker, you have to hit it over that bunker clean or even a little right of it. If that ball is looking left, there's a good chance it's going to bounce after the bunker and roll into the greenside bunker. And not the worst shot in the world, though. I mean, the greenside bunker shot is not that difficult. So it can be a good miss if that's where you end up. The place you don't want to end up is that fairway bunker, because now you're in a somewhat deep bunker with 100 yards to go, maybe a little less, but it's not easy. So that bunker is very penal if you end up in it.
And one of the things we didn't even mention at the top of this hole is, the views are just unbelievable. Probably the best views on the golf course from that tee box, just looking out over the Columbia River Valley. It's truly spectacular backdrop.
I won't take any credit for that, but it sure is beautiful. Lacking an ocean, it's almost as good as an ocean. I've often said that Gamble Sands doesn't have the Pacific like Bandon has, but it has pure fescue turf everywhere and some of the best inland views in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it is spectacular up there on top. Okay, we move on to hole three and we come to our first par five, 592 yards, so it's a substantial length. It's also the first place we encounter some sense of the sandy wash that you were talking about, because it's the forced carry over from the tee on this three-shot par five.
We wanted to get the second hole in, but it meant that the third hole, whatever it was, whether it was a par 3, 4, or 5, you'd be playing uphill from the second across a ridge. So we decided a par 5 would be best to move the games along and give them a chance to get farther out on the property. And so we made an enormously wide fairway. I mean, that fairway is probably the better part of 100 yards wide on top of that ridge. And all you have to do is make the carry over the ridge, which isn't that easy. it's not that it's that far, but I think that it's really intimidating. There's a rock usually or a post on the ridge. I think even now a couple of sets of steps, and the caddies tell you which set of steps would be best for you to aim at. Hopefully they've seen your game for a couple of holes. But the challenge is just to get up there. It doesn't much matter at this point. This is a true par 5, a three-shotter for sure. Very few people making this in two. So you just need to have faith that there's a lot of grass up there and swing smooth and put it up on top.
And then from there, it's kind of out in front of you. The second shot is to keep it between, you know, keep it on the green grass, I guess is the way to say it. And then you play into the green from there. And it's one of the greens on the course that probably has the most room around it and one of the flatter greens on the course, but it still has that front right bunker that seems to be a magnet for a lot of golf balls I've found.
It's one of the few greens that's elevated. And this is an interesting architectural discussion. You know, golf in Scotland, where I'm from, the vast majority of the older golf courses, the greens are at grade. The fairways and the surrounds all flow into the greens, and the greens aren't necessarily above or below the existing surrounds and fairway. You know, they just flow together. They're all at the same grade. When golf came to America, for various reasons, greens became pushed up because of drainage concerns, because of the USGA greens construction methodology, because of the conventions and architecture. For all sorts of reasons, greens became pushed up. And when that happens, you've got contours around the greens that if you miss the green, they're going to bounce the ball away. And that's something, if you go back and you think about your favorite courses in Scotland, you don't see so much. So the third green at Gamble is one of the few on the golf course that are elevated, really only because that's the way the ground was and that's where we decided to put the green. So that par 5 green, if you decided to go for it in two and you've got the range, if you don't make the putting surface, the surrounding contours will reject the ball and it'll actually push you farther away. Not that it's, you know, death by any means. It's not overly penal, but it certainly doesn't gather. And that's one of the few greens that doesn't do that. All of the contours on the front of that green are pushing the ball right. And that's where that green, the single greenside bunker is. It's middle right. So that's why it gathers so much. It doesn't have to be terribly big. And it's really there to punish the guy that's going for it in two. Doesn't quite have the length. The ball's got a little tail on it and it catches those contours and it all gets sucked towards that middle bunker.
So from there, we walk to par 3. 142 yards. Now, when I've played this, I have hit everything from a wedge to a running jigger to knockdown irons. I've literally tried everything to figure out this green. I have been relatively successful only once or twice. You know, talk about kind of how this hole looks. We're going back toward the Columbia River again, so it's another hole with great views. But talk about the strategy of this shorter par 3.
This is one we termed the Redanarets, where it started off as a Redan hole. We intended to build a par 3 that was falling from front left to back right, guarded by a big inside wash bunker, a big waste bunker on the inside right, and a single pot bunker on the outside left of the green. And then somewhere along the line, we put a bit of a trough in the middle of the green, which is an homage, I guess, to the Biarritz style of par 3. So someone, I think Adam Lawrence from Golf Course Architecture, called it a Redanarets, which we embraced and thought that was a funny name for it. Here's a really fun one. As you say, you've tried everything, and yet you haven't tried the one thing that I do when I play that hole, which is a putter.
Yeah.
The putter is the best way to play the fourth at Gamble Sands. There's nothing in the way off the tee, not a single thing. And every contour from the tee to the green is helping that ball get to the green. And then the green falls away from you. So once that ball is rolling, all you have to do is get it vaguely hit hard enough to make it to the front edge. Once it does that, it'll roll right on. The hardest spot on that green is probably the very front. If the pin's at the very front, that's a tough one to get to. But if the pin is middle or back, you can almost hit that putter as hard as you want. The ball will roll down the fairway, get to the green. The green gets softer and the ball will release and roll out onto the green. It's a fun hole and it is very deceiving. Everyone gets up there. They look at the yardage from the regular tee. Is it 130?
142.
Okay, 142. So they're hitting, you know, seven irons, maybe a strong guy's hitting an eight iron. But the wind is blowing. The angles are very deceptive. And that waste bunker on the right sees a lot of golf balls. And it's not an easy recovery from there. And yet, if you over club and hit out left, the ball's going to bounce into that green. So again, there's all these contours. In fact, every contour on that hole is trying to help that ball get on the green if you'd only listen.
That's a good point. It's interesting you mention putter. I played out there with one of the caddies one afternoon, and who also caddies at Bandon Dunes. And he played the entire round with just a putter and a wedge. And it was one of the more fascinating days I've ever had on a golf course, watching him go around Gamble Sands with primarily hitting putter. He really only used a wedge at times that that he needed to, you know, flip over something or you know, hit some type of lofted shot. For the most of the time, he hit putters everywhere, and it was possible to do it.
There's very few holes there that have mandatory force carries. Tough on three. I'd be curious what he did on three with a putter.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll have to go back and remember that. Try to see how he did it. I can't remember exactly what he did. He may have played it from the tees on the other side of the wash, now that I think about it.
Or flattened off a wedge and just punched it or something.
Yeah. Okay, so we move on to hole number five. And hole number five, 462-yard par four. I think most people I speak with about Gamble Sands say number five is their most memorable hole. It's a long par four. You have to cut the corner over the wash area, but you basically get to pick your aggressive line and see what you want to do. And there's a wonderful speed slot down there that will help you get the ball into a manageable iron distance as well. So talk about some of this off the tee, and then certainly we will get to the giant washout bunker that guards the right side of this green.
For the architectural nerds who might be listening, and I'm sure there's a few, when I'm laying these holes out, I'm not trying to copy anything. You know, I'm not thinking, you know, let's build a Redan hole or, you know, the Road hole or an Eden or, you know, we're building the best hole that we can on the piece of ground we're starting with. And sometimes those basic template holes end up being very similar to what we did, but not by design, really more by accident, because the great template holes are just that. I mean, I think they would have ended up coming into existence at some point, no matter how architecture had spun out. So the fifth hole, it could be termed a combination of a cape hole, because the fifth green hangs out over a peninsula. And yet it has elements of a leaving hole, because the front right corner of the green is protected by a giant mound, and you need to get as far left as possible if you want to see into the green. So for the architectural nerds, there would be the architectural definition of it as a cape hole and a leaving hole that birthed the fifth hole at Gamble Sands. Off the tee, it's very dramatic. You're standing on the edge of the big wash that I was mentioning much earlier, the very wash that offered to block our golf hole, our hole routing. And so you're playing up the western edge of this giant wash, and the green is at one end of it, and you're starting at the very end, at the exit end of it. The way that the hole works is that we opened up a lot of open sand in front of you, on the face of the wash in front of you, and you're left with a heroic choice to make. How much of a bite are you willing to take off the tee to get as far down the fairway as possible? And it really, I'm probably confusing golfers on purpose, because if you stopped for a moment and thought about it, you don't really have to take that big a bite at all, because all of the contours of the fairway are pushing the ball down to the right in any case. So instead of being super heroic and taking this big risky shot over open sand down the right-hand side, you can actually hit a far lesser shot way left, and that ball will catch contours and run down to the right in any case, and put you in the same position with a fraction of the risk.
And if you're comfortable with long irons or your hybrids, I've hit some of my best shots into that green being farther back up on and still being up on top before it hits that speed slot and that slope and goes down, because I could see the green from up there on top. Whereas when the ball rolls down to the right-hand side, you're left with a shorter shot. But like you said, you have to go over that wash bunker, which, you know, is daunting, you know, to say the least. You're just looking right into the face of it and saying, wow, how do I hit it up and over this thing?
From that position on the right-hand side of the fifth fairway, the top of that bunker, the mound that bunker is pushed into, is probably 50 feet above you. It is very, very daunting. And you have no comprehension of depth on the other side. You know, how far is that green? You can only go off the yardage you have. And for a lot of people, one thing that I think a lot of amateur golfers don't realize is when you're hitting to a target that's above you, when a green is significantly higher than you are, the parabola, the trajectory of the golf shot is still a forward motion at the point at which it hits the green. So a lot of golfers, I think, wonder why, well, I hit a great shot and the ball rolled to the back of the green. Well, when it came in, it has no chance to stop. It's not dropping yet. It's still coming in pretty flat. And so a green like that, I see a lot of people hitting reasonably good shots into that green and they roll through and are at the very back. So if you're on that right side of the fifth, you need to actually underclub, not overclub, and make sure that you cover the mound, but don't go too deep, because running off the back of that one really causes some trouble and strife.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to say that that's one of my favorite spots on the golf course, up on that green, because you can see so much. You know, you're right there by the sixth tee, but you can look off to the par five seventh that's across another one of the wash areas. It's a high point of the golf course that really lets you kind of see the vistas of what's around you on that section of the golf course.
Par on that hole, and you're going to make for a good day. I mean, there's a lot of grass on that hole, and it's not an overly difficult bogey. If you're willing to hit a tee shot and a layup second shot and then chip onto the green for three and a couple of putts, you'd be out of there. But it can really eat your lunch if you're going after birdies, because that second shot from the right-hand side that's blind, if you make a mistake there, you can be in a world of hurt. So that's the first. The fifth hole, I would say, is the first real test on the golf course, where coming off with par on that hole is actually an achievement.
Well, I think that's an interesting point you make, too, because as we talk more and more about adding width to golf courses, I hear so many people say, well, that makes the golf course easier. And I know that's certainly not your contention. Your idea is the width might help the average golfers, but there are other elements built into your designs that really are there to specifically test really good players as well, and make them, like you said, choose their aggression, choose how they want to attack the hole, and then have to actually execute to really get the ball close.
Width with good strategy, with good architecture, is just about allowing recovery, not much else.
Okay, so we head on to number six. You mentioned hole six earlier, because we crossed the wash here on this fairly long par three, 217 yards from the regular tees. And this starts to take you on a journey through the next section of the golf course. What I love about this hole is exactly what we were just saying, that the guy who can spin it in there can really attack the pin on this hole. But the guy who doesn't have that accuracy but has a little bit of creativity can play the ball front right or well out to the right, because the slope from the green that you walk up to get to the seventh tee actually really helps players who hit the ball along the right side on this green.
I guess the sixth is a good example of width. Now, for the detractors who might say that width can make it too easy, you know, the sixth hole at Gamble's a great case study here. If you're a modest golfer and you want to put the ball on the sixth green, a good caddy should tell you to hit it way right. And the green is maybe, let's say the green is 220 or 210 from your tee, you're playing the regular tee. The caddy would tell you, you only need to hit it, you know, 180. So you hit a rescue club or maybe your 3-wood for some players, anywhere on that slope, anywhere. And that ball will roll down onto the green. Now, depending on where the pin is, that ball might or might not get close. Now, if you're a good golfer, if you're a single-digit golfer, is that going to be what you want to do? Are you willing to take the chance that you're going to hit it randomly onto a hillside and let it roll down onto the putting surface? Or do you think that with nothing in your way, you could hit a 210-yard shot to, you know, 10 feet, 15 feet and hole a birdie putt? Now, I'm a reasonably good golfer. I think I can do that. So I rarely use that kicker slope on the right-hand side, but I often recommend it to higher handicap golfers in my group. So I would say that these slopes are often, if they're used correctly, they have to be balanced with the golfer's ability. And on that particular hole, it's a great case study. Good golfers are going to go for the pin because they want to hole a birdie putt. Average golfers, if they're thinking well, you know, they're going to want to be on the green. So hitting it outright and feeding it down on there is probably the best strategy for them. If they go dead aim and they come up short, they're in a bunker with a 20-yard bunker shot. No one's good at those.
Yeah, the big wraparound bunker on the left would be the deterrent on this hole of going that way. You know, I'm the opposite of what you mentioned. I'm a decent golfer, but as you know, I play with hickories, so I don't spin the ball as much as most people. And so every time I step up on that tee, I'm trying to figure out where that perfect spot is to land it on the right side to get that rollout. Because for me, half of the fun is just watching that ball roll out slowly and get closer and closer to the hole. And I've played the course with guys who have been out there for the first time, you know, quite a few times. People are just amazed that, you know, they see where I hit it and they think, well, you didn't intend to hit it there. And then it starts to roll out and you see it start to trickle toward wherever the flag happens to be. And people say, well, maybe you really did intend to hit it there. So to me, that's part of the fun. And certainly that decision, as you say, is kind of one of those personal decisions that every golfer has to make on how they want to attack that hole. But that's the fun of it as well.
One thing that I learned there was I was building it, and Oren Vincent from OB Sports, he's the founder, was out there. He's a great, great guy, good golfer back in the day. And I was saying to Oren, how do I get the relationship between the steepness of the slope, the flatness of the green, the contours? I mean, it's kind of a guess. I can't drop a golf ball in the sand and tell what it will do. And he said, well, why don't you go use a basketball? That's what I used to do. So we went and got a basketball and we actually dropped it on that slope on six in all sorts of different places, watched where it rolled out to, and decided that that was probably as good as anything. And so we grasped the golf hole based on the roll of a basketball on the hard sand, and worked pretty well, didn't it?
Oh, man, worked out perfectly.
Yeah. So I've used that basketball trick a lot since then.
Yeah, that is a great tip. That is wonderful. We walk up that slope then after hopefully at least making three there on the sixth, and we go to hole number seven, a par five. This is probably, I think, golfer's best shot on the front nine to make eagle, but it's certainly not easy. You know, tell me about standing on this tee to start with on the par five seventh.
So now you're on the other side of it. You're on the eastern side of the wash. And the fifth plays up the west side of it. Now the seventh's going to play up the east side of it. And it starts from a lower tee and it plays uphill, doglegging hard right around the edge of the wash as the wash gets deeper. When you tee off, the wash is maybe 50 feet deep. And by the time you get to the green, it's probably well over 100 feet deep. So it's a pretty dramatic, big open sand feature. And it's on your right now. I guess it's on your right on the fifth too, but now it really is a giant golf ball eating monster. So it's getting ready to eat any slices at all are going to get sucked down into that. And you're going to be down there in the cactus trying to find it. So the hole isn't terribly long. It's very reachable. For most golfers, it's not going to be that big a deal. If they hit two reasonably good shots, they're going to be on that green in two. The danger is that you're overly aggressive off the tee. In order to make sure that to keep everyone a little nervous, there's a bunker on the outside left of the tee shot as well. So you can't just completely bail out miles left. There's a finite distance that's maybe 50 yards. There's a gap between the wash and the fairway bunker. And you could aim 50 yards away from that wash, but you couldn't aim 51 yards away because you'd be in the fairway bunker. So that keeps everyone a little bit honest. But so many people try and cut the corner and it's just not necessary. The safe shot on seven is just to hit it down the middle. Just stay away from the trouble out on the right. Just hit it. Even left half is okay because the fairway cants a little bit to the right and will kick that ball forward and a little bit right and put you in a great spot to go for the green in two. So it's amazing how easy it is for a golf course architect to trick the golfer into using his ego against him. And the seventh is a good example. They see this big wash on the inside and they think, well, I must try and carry it. Really, you don't need to. It doesn't really help. So stay away from it, hit it down into green grass and get in play. And then the second shot gives you the chance to be aggressive. If you're down in the junk off the tee, the second shot is purely a recovery shot. There's no way to go for the green from down there. You're just hacking it back up on the fairway for a lost stroke.
Exactly. And so if you're standing in the fairway for that second shot, you know, you've played with their mind a little bit more. Up by the green, there's quite a bit of room left. You can try to play this safely to the left of the green rather than take on the giant bunker complex and try to carry it that's in the front right. But you also have thrown a couple other bunkers just into their visual line, one in the middle of the fairway and then one up on the left side.
The one in the middle of the fairway is a bit like number two. It's to force people to consider the layup. I don't want you to just take any club you want and just lay up to whatever convenient yardage you want to lay up to. I want you to have to be accurate and to think about the yardages on a layup shot. So it's not just toward. It has to be toward with some meaning. And so that's what the bunker's for there. And then on the green, as you say, the green is big. It's got some rolling contours on it, but it's very deep. All the contours to the left of the green are pushing on, and there's a giant backboard at the back of the green. So if the pin's front or middle, you can play to the left side of that green, and the ball will want to bounce to the right and onto the green. And if the pin's middle or back, you can throw it really deep onto the backboard, and it'll roll back down onto the pin. So there's, again, a lot of contours there that are off the green that will help you if you don't want to take dead aim, if you want to use those contours to your advantage. The thing that you don't want to do is the guy off the tee rips one down the right. He puts himself hard right down the fairway, and he's left with a second shot to that green that's semi-blind uphill across 30 yards of open sand into a green that you have to stop it dead because you can't use any of the contours to your advantage. So off the tee, again, if you're middle or left, all these contours come into play and you can use them. If you go down the right, none of them can help you.
So we walk up from there, again, walking from that green, we walk up a little bit to the eighth tee, and we have another short par four here, 284 yards from the regular tees. Do you consider this hole to be a drivable hole?
I think it's drivable. And Casey and I spent a lot of time scratching our head, wondering, could we build a drivable par four that is blind? I mean, you see the top of the pin, but you can't see the green. You can't see the bottom of the pin. You can't see anything around the green off the tee, but you can see the pin. And we decided, yes, it's a fun shot. So the green is, or the hole is really set up as a straightaway fairway that runs past the green. It's almost like the green is sitting to the left of a conventional fairway. And so if you want to, you can stand on the tee, hit it down the fairway and be pin high, and then chip it 90 degrees onto the green, and you'd have two putts for par. Very safe. I mean, you can make an easy par there by just not even considering going for the putting surface, because the putting surface falls away from you and it has deep bunkers down its right-hand side or leading up to it on down the right-hand side. So aggressive shots are well defended against. But if you want to make par, you can hit it down the fairway to the right of the green and chip it on. But it's so tempting. You know, once you know that hole, you know that if you can get it online with that hard fescue, sandy turf, the ball will bound and roll, catch the front of the green falls away, it'll roll right down onto the green. You could have an eagle putt. So it's very, very tempting. I see a lot of players go for that green and they end up tugging it a little bit left, and they end up in the no man's land between the eighth green and the ninth tees. And I realized about a year after, maybe two after the course opened, that a lot of players ended up there, and we had some deep, wispy fescues in there, and it was difficult to recover. And players were hunting balls. So I went back in and I kind of scabbed out that area. So it's partially little chunks of fescue, but mostly it's just an open, sandy waste area now. So you can easily find the ball, but it is no picnic of a recovery shot. You've got to hit a 30-yard bunker shot from a pan-flat bunker lie, and it's downhill. So it's a very tricky little shot to hit. The safe shots to dink it down the right, chip it on the green, two putts, and you're out of there. But who wants to do that when you can make eagle?
It's funny you say that, because I've never tried to actually drive this green, but I've also never, ever played it out to the right. I've always tried to take the aggressive line with it and kind of lay it up between, I guess you have three bunkers kind of in succession there, and there's room between two of them. I've always tried to stay a little bit left of those or in between them, and then, you know, hit a little runner up onto that green. But every time I'm standing on that green, I look off to the right and I think to myself, why is there this entire fairway of space to the right of the green? And so now, listening to you explain it, it makes a lot more sense to me now, and I'll probably play it a completely different way next time.
I guess there might be a little hint of the fact that my normal game, I've got a little, a little fade on it. So if I go for it and I fade it, as long as I fade it enough, or maybe it's called a slice, I end up out in that fairway. And I can just chip it back onto the green and I'm still got a birdie putt. So it's a fun hole. I like the fact that it's partially blind. You don't know what you're going to get as your group is moving up on that green. You know who hit good ones, you know who hit ones that weren't so good, but there's the mystery of the contours and not quite knowing how it all worked out. So I like the sense that there's this drama on that hole. I wrote a piece for Golf Course Architecture recently about blindness, and I talked about the fact that I thought blindness was a bit like faith, where if you're going to give me something blind and I use my faith to believe you, then you can't do something terribly bad to me, right? It has to kind of work out relatively okay. It can't be death over the hill if it was blind. So that's what the eighth does. It's not overly penal, and I'm encouraging you to go for it. And if you make a reasonably good shot, you got an eagle putt. And if you don't, you can still rescue a birdie and pretty easily a par.
We had the nine. And nine at 355 yards from the regular tees, it's a par four. It always feels much longer to me than 355 yards. There's a lot to maneuver here. And I think the variety of par four lengths, like we're talking about with the eighth, being short, and the second being short, but the fifth being longer and having different ways to play it. I think that's truly one of the strengths of the golf course. But here you have kind of a pinch point at about 130 yards out from the green. You've got bunkers on both sides, and I have been in both of them. You do not want to go there. So tell me a little bit about how you play the ninth.
Definitely plays a lot longer than its yardage. I would say the ninth plays more like a 400-yard par four than a 350. The second shot is severely uphill, much more uphill than you think. And the fairway pinches to the point that for a lot of golfers, you can't hit driver or you shouldn't. It pinches way in and all the contours are kicking into a deep death bunker on the right-hand side that you can't even see off the tee. So for me, hitting it out left and short of the fairway bunker that cuts halfway across the fairway is the safest tee shot, but it leaves me at 170 out uphill into the ninth green. So suddenly a 350-yard hole on the card, you'd think, well, that's a driver wedge, turns into a 3-wood 5-iron. It's no picnic, as you well know. And going in the bunkers is definitely bogey. I mean, extremely difficult to rescue yourself from either of those bunkers. So for me, I hit it out left, way left, like almost left edge, and just stay away from everything. And then I feel pretty confident that I can hit a long iron up and onto that green and give myself two putts for par. On that particular hole, I feel like if I make par there, I got away with something because making bogey is very easy because that you can't hit it where you want to hit it. I do see some really good players who will just rope a driver tight to the left-hand bunker and they'll go through the bunkers and they will actually get down to a wedge. But for me, I'm not as accurate with the driver as I'd like to be. And I know that going in those bunkers is a surefire bogey or worse. So I'd rather take my chances hitting it to the left half of the fairway short of the bunker and then a long iron into the green.
Well, and the one thing that really helps, I have hit a lot of shots from farther back where you're talking about the 170, 180 yard mark. And the fact that you have a huge backdrop on this golf hole allows people to take a hybrid or a fairway wood or a long iron from that longer shot and play it off that back hill and bring the ball back down.
Hitting left of the green, you know, pin high left will never hurt you. Pin high right is into another bunker. So you need to hit it left, if you're looking to just make a safe par.
Exactly. And then the green itself is two-tiered. I've hit one of my better shots and possibly the best putt of my life on the ninth. So it holds a special place in my heart. I hit a long shot into that backboard, thinking I had played it perfectly. The pin was on the left side of this side-by-side two-tiered green. And I thought, oh, this is going to run up the slope. It's going to come right back down. It's going to be close to the pin. It got a little bit too far right, and it ended up on that right tier. And now I'm faced with this 45 to 90 degree breaking putt that has to take this slope and you have to hit it perfectly. And I was out there playing with a friend of mine, Joe Sass, and I made this miraculous putt, and it's one of those that I'll always remember. But it's more the shot, hitting in the shot to use the backboard is what I think about with that hole, because again, it's another example of how many different ways you can try to do this.
You know, overall, now that we finished the front nine, I mean, it's all about the variety. You know, there are holes out there that if you walked away with a par, you'd think you left one, you know, a shot out there. And there are holes, if you walked away with par, you'd think you did really well. So our intention was to create this rollicking drama of a golf course where nothing's predictable. There's so much variety. You're constantly excited and on edge looking for what's coming next. You know, the holes that are relatively easy and the holes that will absolutely eat your lunch, and they're back to back.
Okay, we've wrapped up the front nine. We're headed to the back nine. There's no return to the clubhouse at Gamble Sands. We are just walking up a little slope behind the ninth green, and we're going to the 10th tee, and we get the shortest par three on the golf course, 126 yards from the regular tees. And this is a tricky, tricky little green I've found every time I've tried to tackle it.
The putting surface is probably the wildest green on the golf course. And the logic is simple. You're only hitting a wedge or a nine iron. It's downhill. You're in a bowl. All the contours around that green are generally helping you. So missing the green is not going to be terribly bad unless you miss short, which is all open sand. So it's an all open sand carry to a wild green with surrounding contours that are helpful. So my ask is accuracy. You're only hitting a short iron downhill. I'm not going to let you have a 30-foot flat putt. You need to get it to, you know, 10 feet. 10 feet is makeable. 20 feet, it might break 3 feet. So that's the ask. If the pin is at the front or on the far right, those are the two hardest spots on the green to hit because those pin placements are very small. If the pin's middle or back, it's a lot easier. You've got some room to miss and the ball will feed and you're not so bad. But all too often I see that pin front and right and you think, those are the tough ones. You got to get the yardage exactly right.
And if you can figure out a birdie there, or if you hit it in the sand and end up making a bogey or double, the new outpost Snack Shack is right there at the 10th. And so you can go drown your sorrows a little bit with a beverage to take to power you through the rest of the holes, I guess.
Between the cart girl and the outpost, there's no shortage of cold beers out there.
Exactly. Okay, we had the holes 11 and 12, kind of a nice little back-to-back stretch of par fours that are running in the same direction. The 11th is a little bit longer at 380. The 12th is very short at 304. Let's kind of talk about that sequence.
Again, they don't play their yardages. You know, the 380 11th plays a lot shorter. You can cut. If you're aggressive and you cut the corner, you could get that hole down to a driver and a, you know, punch eight iron or a full wedge. But if you play safe out to the left, you could be hitting driver six iron. So that fairway or that hole, even though it marks at 380, the numbers are always, it's an interesting thing because the yardages of a golf course are set by, in this case, the Washington State Golf Association and in all others by their regional associations. They're the ones who decide the yardage. You know, so it's quite often we don't know exactly what yardages the course is going to come out at when we build these things. Sometimes they're hundreds of yards different, shorter or longer than we'd originally intended because they decide on a different turn point. And the 11th would be a good example. You know, that hole at 380, I think, plays more like 350 because most reasonably good golfers take a more aggressive line than the defined turning point for the length of the hole. So you're standing on that tee and there's a big inside wash bunker that just prevents you from going over it very easily. So that forces you to make a decision on the left side. You have to decide to stay left of that bunker. But there's another little pot bunker just inside it, maybe 15 yards. And so there's the conundrum. You want to be as close as possible to that big inside wash. But if you're 15 yards away from it, you could fly it right into a pot bunker. So a really aggressive line has to fly that pot bunker, but not go into the one on the right to put you in the best position. And there's always the option to go way left. There's 60, 70, 80 yards left of all that trouble that could put you in green grass and give you a perfectly reasonable long second shot into that green. But you're not probably making birdie. So for the players that are being aggressive, that mix of the big inside left wash and the small pot bunker are the real focus of attention. And I'll take this moment to talk about those that might think that width in any way at all panders to golfers. There you have a hole right there that doglegs hard right and has a fairway that's 100 yards wide. A good golfer doesn't see it. They see a big inside bunker and a pot bunker that are 15 yards apart. If you're a good golfer, that 15-yard gap is what you're looking at. Can I thread that with my driver and put myself down to a wedge into this green? The width means nothing.
And if you hit it, if you take the quote-unquote safe route and play well out to the left, you've put a bunker kind of in the front left side of this green that then kind of plays havoc with your approach from that far left side, because now all of a sudden you're having to figure out how to maneuver that bunker. Whereas if you've taken the more aggressive line and you've pulled it off down that right side, you know, you can almost just forget about that bunker on the left side and play much more aggressively at the pin.
Yeah, that bunker is pretty much in the middle of the green. The green's running across you widthways, and that bunker is dead in the middle of that. And it actually has slopes on the backside of it that are kicking hard onto the green, but not in a good way. You know, there, if you cover the bunker and you hit that downslope with a low trajectory shot, it's going to kick you all the way through the green, and there's another bunker at the back. So taking that aggressive line down the right gives you a much better chance to throw a short club into that green and get it close to the pin. If you take the wimp out far left off the tee, you're probably better playing to the left or right half of that green and making a long putt close to the pin for a par. So there's lots of strategy going on there with all that width, but certainly not easy. There has to be some thinking off the tee.
Well, and there certainly does on the 12th as well, because now we're much shorter, you know, 300 yards. And again, you've brought a bunker into the sight line on the more aggressive right-hand side, but there's also a very big kind of sandy wash bunker on the left front of the green. So again, if you play out to the left, which is the safer line, you now have to hit this flip shot over this larger bunker. And if the pin, especially if the pin is up front on the 12th, it is not an easy shot at all, even with a wedge in your hand.
It's fun to design a hole that's 300 yards and is a real conundrum. You know, you stand on the tee, average guy stands on the tee, there's a pot bunker in the middle of the fairway at 180. So if he wants to lay up to a wedge, he really can't. There's a pot bunker right in exactly the spot he would want to lay up. So, okay, now I have to make a decision. If I go right of that, there's not much room. If I go left of it and I go too far, I could run all the way up and into the greenside bunker. If I want to lay up with a three wood, I have to accept a flip over that bunker that's greenside and onto the green blind. And if I want to go for the green, I either have to fly all the way to the green and then stop it pretty quick, or hit it down the right-hand side, pin high, and use the contours to feed on, which is really the smart play. So if you're going to go for that green, hitting to the right side of the green, way right, 10, 15, 20 yards right of that green, and hit it as hard as you can, all the contours right of that green are pushing onto the green. So the balls that I've seen make the green off the tee are all played to the right, wide right of the green pin high, and it'll all feed on. The smart play, I think, is to hit something down the left-hand side and then just flip it up and onto the green. Well, when I say smart, safer, right? Because you're probably not going to get in the trouble if you hit it down the left-hand side. Just don't hit it far enough to get into the greenside bunker. So it's a long iron or maybe a short rescue club.
We head to 13 and 14, which is, I think, my favorite back-to-back. Having just been over to your homeland and getting to play some golf in Scotland, and especially getting over to the Kintyre Peninsula, where you spent time learning the game, the 13th hole, more than any of the others at Gamble Sands, kind of makes me feel like a hole design that you would find in Scotland.
Off of old Tom Morris's Macrahanish, couldn't it? Could. It feels very like it.
Yeah, and with the sunken green at the very end of it. So it's a par five. It's relatively short at 504 yards. It has a couple of bunkers that you are maneuvering along the way, and then it plays to this sunken green complex, which, you know, reminded me of hitting shots into greens at Dunaverty, or like you said, playing Macrahanish Old. And so just talk about this hole and how you kind of work your way through it, because it really is another one of these where you have to think your way through to give yourself the best chance to try to hit it close on that third shot. Or if you're a person who's going for it, you know, you certainly have a whole nother set of issues.
It's pretty reachable. So off the tee, you're thinking to yourself, if I hit a good tee shot, then I've got a pretty good opportunity to reach this in two. Off the tee, you're slightly elevated. You're looking into a giant wide fairway. And the only real hazard is a big open sand area on the right-hand side. And the hole off the tee is dog-legging a little bit to the right. So if you want to get as far down the fairway as possible, taking on the corner of that bunker is helpful if you want to get there in two. So for me, I line up on the edge of that big open sand area, pointing at the little pot bunker away in the distance, and I hit it as hard as I can down this fairway, knowing that I can pretty easily make it there in two. If you don't want to make it in two, then you've got all the room in the world out to the left, and you can play it as a three-shotter. That's your decision off the tee. For me, if I can get one away and I get down the fairway, my next shot is, the green is really a kind of a punch bowl. You know, it's down in a hollow. It's not a conventional fabricated punch bowl as many are. You know, this was a natural hollow that was blind from the direction we're coming at it from, where it really, it has a ridge in front of it. So for the second shot, if you're going to try and make it to the green, you know that all you really have to do is cover the ridge. So even though the green might be 250 yards away, the top of the ridge is only 210 away. So if you can cover the top of the ridge, the ball is going to run down onto the green. The ridge is big enough that you can't see the pin. So the only way of knowing where the pin is maybe the caddy knows, or maybe, you know, someone else told you. But most of the time, you don't know where the pin is on the green. So it's a complete crapshoot. I know that I'm aiming for about the middle of the ridge. In fact, from the middle of the fairway, the line is usually the clubhouse, which is way in the distance. But normally you can see the clubhouse. And I tell people, aim at that. And if you cover the ridge, it'll run down and onto the green. And then it's just dependent on where the pin is on the green.
If you don't cover the ridge and you've played it slightly to the right, the bunker that is in the face of that ridge is certainly something that can ruin your score on that hole.
Again, it's one of those things. I see people hit it into that bunker and they get in there and they say, well, the green's 30 yards away. And so they start setting up for a 30-yard bunker shot. And I try and say to them, it's not. It's a 5-yard bunker shot. In fact, all you have to do is get the ball out of the bunker, because the top of the bunker runs all the way down and onto the green. So don't think about the green. Just think about covering the top lip of this bunker, and that ball's going to run all the way down and in. Because trying to make a 30-yard bunker shot, you know how that works out. It either goes 3 yards or 50 yards.
Exactly.
Very difficult to judge. So getting into that bunker, which I do often, doesn't really faze me, because I know all I have to do is just sand wedge it out and let it run down onto the green. I still have a birdie putt. I'm still on the green in three.
There are so many, we've talked about obscured shots throughout Gamble Sands, but when it comes to the 14th, it's all right there. You get to, you know, from that elevated tee box, just behind the 13th green, you get to see everything. You see the forest carry off the tee. You see this double fairway of sorts that you've built out there. You see a possible forced carry approach to the green that has to carry another sandy area on the right. And you see the green itself, which again has another huge backboard that is not only fun to hit shots into on the approach and try to see how you can play them, but even when you're on the green and trying to figure out how to get balls close to certain pins, using that backboard as a way to putt can be a lot of fun as well.
Like you say, it's all out there in front of you. It's another hole where the golfer's ego is what gets them in trouble. The hole is best played by taking the least aggressive line off the tee and just putting it into the widest part of that fairway, and then hitting a second shot using that big backboard. You can throw the ball deep and not get into any trouble at all. But golfers' egos being what they are, they see that carry and they think, well, I could get this ball way closer than that. I could take a big bite out of this and put myself to a wedge distance. And so they get overly aggressive and they end up somewhere in that sand. And they go from offense to defense in a hurry. And now they're scrambling to try and rescue a par out of it. It's really fun how, as a golf course architect, you can lay out a hole that has all this common sense looking back at you, and yet the golfer just can't help himself but, you know, turn into a drug addict and start making bad decisions.
This green too is one of those that if the pin is on one side and you are on the other side, it can be quite the challenge. And I think maybe talk a little bit about, all the greens are pretty sizable at Gamble Sands. Do you have a few tips for listeners who are playing there in terms of just how to approach putting on these greens?
Gamble Sands, like a few courses I've built, is not fabricated. You know, there's no greens construction. Those greens are the same grass and the same sand as the fairway. So there's no reason not to make them big. The only limiting factor is the spacing of the irrigation heads. So why not make them big? For me, putting is an underused American golfer trait. They don't putt enough. And it's probably a symptom of the push-up greens that we've seen built here over the last 100 years. That's what golf is in America. You know, wet, thick grass to a green that's above you. When you're around it, when you miss the green is above you. So that's where the Mickelson wedge has such lore. But Gamble Sand speaks more to golf from my country, where the greens are not elevated and it's the same grass everywhere. It's not wet, thick turf. And so putting from off the green is an essential part of the game if you want to score. You know, for golfers to learn how to putt with rescue clubs, to learn how to putt with their putter but using their wrists, to learn how to putt with a wedge, to just bump it forward. You know, these are all incredibly essential skills on a course like Gamble. Every bit as essential as the tee shot, and maybe more so to score. But those would be the things I would say. Gamble's greens are relatively benign once you get within 10 or 15 feet. Those putts generally are not going to break wildly. The fescue doesn't run particularly fast. You know, 10 is on a stimp meter would be a great day at Gamble. 11 is almost impossible. So the greens are relatively slow, and putts don't break a whole lot. So you can be fairly aggressive once you're inside maybe 10 or 15 feet, because it's only going to go a couple of feet past if you miss. It's an easy putt back.
Well put. We moved to 15, 361, and this is really a beautiful hole that turns back toward the river. You know, we start heading back that direction a little bit. It has some very distinctive wash areas that you've put into play. One on the right side off the tee, and it really shouldn't be in play, but for some reason I find people finding it in play. And then, of course, when you get up to the green, the left side is well protected as well. Just talk about that hole.
To preface what's coming next, 15, 16, and 17 are no cakewalk. This is where the real teeth of the golf course comes out. And I think this speaks to the fact that as a Scot, my golf has always been match play. That's what you play. And so matches are won and lost on 15, 16, and 17. They more often than not don't make it to 18, and they aren't settled before 15. So those three holes on a lot of the courses I've done are really deciding a match. So you want those holes to be the most dramatic, the most heroic, the most full of drama, the death and disaster, hero and worship all happen in each of those holes, because they're where a match will end and you don't want it to be an anticlimax. So 15 is a really tough par four. The tee shot is no cakewalk. You're looking at a short diagonal bunker that's actually diagonal into the fairway. So it starts short on the right-hand side. It's actually angling deeper into the fairway. So hitting it down the dead middle of that fairway can put you in that diagonal bunker. Hitting it right of that diagonal could actually carry it and put you on the hard right side of the fairway and give you a pretty favorable angle in. So that is one strategy, is to go hard right over the diagonal, shortest part of it, and give yourself a shot from the right-hand side. Another strategy would be to hit it left of that diagonal bunker and run it down as far as you can down the fairway. But then that leaves you with a shot over a very long sandy waste area that butts right up against the green. So you might be hitting a 7-iron, 6-iron, but most of it is carryover open sand to a green that's hard up against that sand. So that shot's no cakewalk either. And if you lay up short of that, you're hitting three woods and rescue clubs into a green that has sand on both sides. So that you really have to start making decisions at this point. There's no easy out on the 15th. Whereas many of the other holes, I've said, okay, here's your aggressive choices, and then I'll give you a way out. I'll give you a place to miss where you could probably still make par by missing over here or wimping out. From these three holes, there's none of that. You have to make a decision. You have to play golf. You can't miss. There's nowhere to miss two.
Yeah, 15 and 17 both. I tend to find myself just hoping I can get around the front of the green or just off the front of the green and chip and putt to make a four. And honestly, I'm happy with a bogey on either one of these holes. So it's definitely a stretch that does challenge you. We walk up from 15 green and go to the 16th tee. We've got 167 yard par three. It has a backboard again. It's got a way for you to play it off the right, but you've also put a bunker pretty much in the middle, I guess just off to the left of middle, that people have to negotiate as well. So again, it's another one of these. Do you fly it in there and try to spin it and be ultra aggressive, especially when the pin is around that part of the green? Or do you kind of try to play it safe off there and leave yourself with a lengthy putt that is certainly no gimme two putt?
Longish par three. You know, a lot of people are hitting long irons and rescue clubs. I've even seen drivers hit there. I think the backboard is underutilized. That the backboard to that hole is really, really steep. There's no way a ball could hang on it. And so the safest shot is to play for that backboard. Forget about the pin. Aim for the middle of the green and just play for the slope behind the green and let it roll back down and onto the putting surface. If you're really good, it rolls back down and to the left as it comes off the slope. So if you're right of the pin and you use the backboard, it will always get closer than it would do if you hit left of the pin. The bad thing to do is miss this green either short or left. That becomes a really difficult recovery short or left.
Yeah, from that bunker or from the left side, it is truly an up and down because you're hitting back up to the green. And again, you probably have to, if you're chipping up, you probably have to try to use the backboard again. One of the things I like about this hole a lot visually is this bunker you've put way out on the right. Another one of these bunkers that probably shouldn't be in play, but a guy who comes to that green and thinks about, well, I'm going to hit it out to the right side safe and let it kind of run down. That bunker just is kind of just sitting there staring at you in addition to the one that's right in front of the green. And so, again, it just kind of plays with your mind more than it's part of true strategy, I guess.
Something that's often missed by in the architectural books is they talk about bunkers and what all of their reasonings are. You know, they're defending a line or, you know, giving a line or stopping a ball getting in a worse position. I think I often use bunkers to take an option off the table. You know, I certainly do it on par fours where I'll position a bunker for no other reason than to take that position away, a bit like chess. You know, I'm taking a square off the board by putting a pawn there. And so it takes, you don't have that option anymore. I don't want it to be a lost ball or anything. I mean, if you mistakenly hit it in there, you can recover it. But I don't knowingly want you to play for that slope or that position in a fairway. And so that on 16, there's no missing to the front right corner. That bunker does mark that you could hit it over that bunker way farther right than you think. Next time you're there, go look at how far right you could actually hit a ball and it would still roll down and onto that green. It's halfway between 16 green and 17 tee and the ball would still make it down on the green.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of bunkers that play with your mind, 17 is one of these sandy waste bunker areas all the way down the right side of the fairway. And I've been down there a few times. It's not really where you want to be.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest expanse of open sand on a single golf hole. It runs from just past the forward tee all the way past the green. It's probably 200 plus yards long, exposed hillside. And off the tee, it's a simple choice. You know, how big a bite are you willing to take off that diagonal hillside of open sand? The danger is that going into it is extremely penal. It's deep and soft sand, and you're still way out, 100 to 150 yards from the green, on a very shallow angle to the green. So you'd be playing along the length of that bunker, just on the edge of it, to get back to the green. So I, and I'm sure many others, have gotten in that bunker off the tee, hit a 100-yard recovery shot, only to see it land 100 yards further up in the same bunker. So that is no fun at all. When I get to that one, I have to try and mentally block out that whole ridge of sand and just think about the other side of the fairway. I'm going to hit it to the left-hand side of 17 fairway. As hard as I can, I'm going to hit it through the fairway. Try and not have that in my head as I hit the ball. As you know, if you don't take a big enough bite off that corner and you pound one through, you can actually end up on the other side of the fairway, down in a hollow with another bunker in the blocking your line. So it's a tough tee shot to both cover the big sandy ridge, but don't hit it so far that you go through the fairway and give yourself a near impossible shot from the left hand side. So if you're a real stick, you're going to hit a little butter fade off that tee and let it cross the bunker and then keep moving to the right and put you in perfect position. A shot I've pulled off only once or twice in all the rounds I've played, but it sure feels good when you do it.
That's funny you say that. I've always thought this hole is the most difficult, at least for me, the most difficult hole in the golf course. I mean, it's only 406 yards as a par four, so it's not overly long. But like you said, you've got what's lurking down the right. You've added just enough with that bunker on the left. And then the approach shot, the farther left you go, once again, as we talk about this all the way through the round, the farther left you go, now you have to negotiate a rather large bunker that protects the front side of the green. Maybe not large isn't the right word, but a very visual bunker that you have to carry the crest of to try to get a ball close. And so, you know, I found myself, again, like with this one, trying to just play short and right of that greenside bunker, or trying to hit it just well left of it and hoping to chip and putt in, because there is a lot of room beyond it off to the left of the green. But really dialing a shot in from that left side over that bunker is a difficult task.
17 is a good example of a hole where, as golfers, we get so focused on the pin and we don't think about things behind it. You know, 17, a bit like the 17th on the old course, there's no trouble behind the green. And so all of this trouble lays immediately in front of the green. And the smart play is often just to play for the back of that green and putt back to the pin. So for me, if I can get a reasonably good tee shot away and the pin is in really anywhere on that green, I just try and play to the back of the green. And maybe I get lucky and it comes up a little short. But I certainly, going for the pin, if it's middle or front, has so much danger that it's just, I don't think it's worth the risk. I go for the back of that green, and then I'll take my two putts coming from the back of the green back to wherever the pin is.
So 15, 16, and 17, we have probably taken their toll on us, but we've arrived at the 18th, 452-yard par 5 to close. I think it's one of the more fun finishing holes anywhere in golf, because you can truly finish on a high note scoring wise if you execute, and it will keep you coming back for more whether you execute or not. But you've got bunkers that kind of pinch the tee shot landing area, but if you can get in between those and catch the speed slot, I mean, your approach into this green can be with an iron in hand, even for the average golfer.
I'm assuming that if you're playing match play, which I don't know how many people do, the match is over by the time you got to 18, and now you're on the Aloha Press. and so, you know, it's bombs away, par five, finishing hole. You know, you want to play aggressive. Who wants to play the very final hole tentatively and nervously? So I'm giving you the opportunity to bomb one down the fairway. If you miss the speed slot, you're still more than capable of making par. But if you catch that speed slot, which is probably, it's maybe 20 yards wide off the tee, it will run all the way down. I've hit 8-iron into that green. So it's a very, very makeable eagle if you can make a good tee shot. And the green is long and skinny and all feeding in. There's a soft feeder slope from the right-hand side. So even if you're a little farther back, if you can chase one on the front right side, it will run down and onto the green. You could still have an eagle putt. So there's lots of opportunity for scoring on the 18th if you can get a good tee shot away. You'd probably have to work hard to make a double bogey there. You'd really have to flail one off into the weeds off the tee.
But even the bunkers, I mean, if you probably destroy your chance at birdie with a tee shot that finds one of those two bunkers in the pinch point, wouldn't you say?
All on the left is so flat that I've hit, you know, 3 wood out of that bunker and still put it on the green. So down the left is still doable. Down the right, I think that would be harder because it's got a little bit of a lip on it, and you're coming into the green at the wrong angle. So much harder to make the green out of the right-hand bunker, but doable out the left. I've done that a few times.
And I found that I play, you mentioned the feeder slope on the right side. I found that I play that almost all the time now on that approach shot because when I'm approaching from a ways out, because it's just much the safer play. And you've got that wraparound bunker that kind of is on the left side and running behind the green. You know, you definitely don't want any part of that.
As I said many times, you know, all of these slopes are out there. The vast majority are out there to help you. You just have to listen. You just have to be looking for it and aware. For a lot of good golfers, they're not going to give them the proximity they're after. So they start taking dead aim. And for the smarter golfers or the average golfers, they should be looking for them because they're going to make a huge difference to your score and your enjoyment of the game.
I've been to Gamble Sands 3 times now. Obviously, we're planning another trip that we'll talk about in a minute. But, you know, I've played probably 10 rounds around the golf course. I can't remember a time walking off the 18th where anybody in any group that I've been in has not had a smile on their face. It's pure fun. A lot of people I see shooting their best scores if they've been able to, like we've been talking about, think their way around the golf course as opposed to trying to just overpower it. And, you know, I think the 18th is one of those where, you know, I see guys make eagles. I may see guys make birdies and they just walk off and they're ready to go up to Danny Boy Bar and Grill, sit on the patio, have a drink and, you know, watch the other groups come in and see how they do as well.
The course is built to be as much fun as possible. And I think that people who haven't been there might hear what people say and try and find fault in it. Try and think that, well, the width is making it too easy or the scale is reducing strategy. But I hope that you'd agree that that couldn't be farther from the truth. There's plenty of strategy there. There's plenty of opportunity for heroics and disaster. It's simple. The width allows confidence off the tee and the ability to recover. It's really as straightforward as that. It doesn't mean that the course isn't full of strategy and intrigue and fun.
And I know personally, I've made everything from, I think, a 2 to an 11 on various holes out there. So there's certainly disaster lurking in a few spots.
I'm glad that you enjoy it so much. It gives me a thrill that you and many, many others have such a fun time out there. It gives me a huge amount of confidence going forward that the path that I redirected onto about a decade ago is entirely the right one for the game.
Well, and now there's going to be a lot more. We're heading out there, a group of media in May. You're going to be there with us for a few days. We're going to have a few lucky Twitter followers as well are going to make the trip. And not only are we going to play the Sands course, but hopefully we're going to see the work you're doing on a short course and possibly a second full course out there, right?
Course is all staked out and we're working towards the beginnings of that. I'm not exactly sure when it is. The owners are still figuring all of the timings out, but we've already done all the design work. We'll see what happens.
Wonderful. Well, I can't thank you enough, David. It's been a lot of fun remembering Gamble Sands and reliving around out there. And I look forward to getting together with you and actually playing 18 holes. And we can put all this into practice together and see who comes out the winner in a good match.
It'll be fun to see you play with hickories. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to chat with you.
All right. So there you have it. Our first Talking Yardage book conversation on the Talking Golf Getaways podcast. Darren, I was absolutely fascinated by this. It really made me want to listen to it again and again, which I will no doubt do in anticipation of my first visit to Gamble Sands, which will be coming up in May. And the only way to put it is, I can't wait. All caps.
Well, we're all pretty excited about that trip in May. It's going to be me and you and a few members of our team, plus some other media members, plus a few lucky Twitter followers. We're going to have a great time. You know, Gamble Sands is just such a fun place to play. I'm sure that came out in the podcast, maybe even too much so, since I tend to gush about the place. But we've said it before, David McClay Kidd has been on a design journey over his life. And now that he's become what I like to call the ambassador of fun, I think Gamble Sands is the best example of building a golf course that dares average golfers without destroying them.
That is so perfectly put on every front, especially the ambassador of fun. Have you run that by David McClay Kidd?
I don't know. I think when we go in May, we all need to get t-shirts made that say ambassador of fun.
And we have to get him some kind of something. Of course, he's going to listen to this now and he'll know it's coming. But I think we should have something, a crown maybe, some kind of thing, an actual ambassador thing. We'll figure it out. But I totally agree with you. And I think he gets it. And that's going to spread, hopefully, to a lot of other golf courses and architects as well. So thanks for the work you put in on this. As I said, I know you've been dreaming of this one for a long time. And I can now see how this will become a great regular series for us on Talking Golf Getaways. Thanks to the listeners. Obviously, we couldn't do it without you. Don't forget to visit the new GolfTripX.com, golf travel website for more podcasts. You'll be able to read great stories, poke around different sections. Click on the ads. Please do that, because that's how we make our money, to be able to keep spotlighting the best in golf travel across the country and beyond. So go click on them. David McClay Kidd has always had a dream to bring fun golf to the masses. Darren and I have a dream to inform, entertain, and inspire golf travelers with our new GolfTripX.com website. We hope you have a dream too. Go run it down. Thanks for being with us. So long.